Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
He whom you see here, of aquiline visage, of chestnut hair, of open and untroubled brow, of cheerful eyes, and hooked, though well-proportioned, nose, his beard silver, which only 20 years ago was golden, the mustache big, the mouth small, the teeth not important, for there are but six, and they are ill-conditioned and worse placed, having no correspondence with one another. Someone bent of shoulder and not very light of foot. He is commonly called Miguel de Cervantes Saavedra. And here is painted not only the aging writer's self-portrait, but the figure into which he projected his spirit, the child of his pen, Don Quixote de la Mancha. At the very end of his book, which is one of the earliest to be constructed, Cervantes writes, "For me alone, Don Quixote was born, and I for him, it was for him to act, and me to write, and we two are one. Both men, creator and created, were of boundless hope, both committed to living as if the dream was real. Both were men, real and fiction, of great and deep dignity, in spite of everything. Miguel de Cervantes was born in Spain in 1547. Sorry, I lost my place while I was doing that. He was born to an old family, but one which had seen better days. If there had been knights or nobles among them, they were long gone and long forgotten. His father was an apothecary and a surgeon, a wanderer and a ne'er-do-well, but a gentleman, nevertheless. Life for Cervantes was unremarkable, certainly unadventurous, until in 1571 he joined the Spanish fleet and took part in the famous Battle of Lepanto. In this battle he had a moment of glory, which he would not experience again until his later years, with the phenomenal success of his book, Don Quixote. Lying in the bowels of the Spanish man-o-war, he insisted that his friends carry him up onto the deck so that he could join the fight. And even after short shots caught him twice, once in the chest and one that took away forever the use of his left hand, he fought on to his last ounce of courage. In later years, he said, "If it were possible now to work a miracle in my case, I would still rather have taken part in that prodigious battle than be today free of my wounds without having been there." On his return to Spain from Lepanto, Cervantes and his brother were captured by the Moors, and here again he displayed remarkable courage, being the ringleader in several unsuccessful attempts to escape. In spite of his troublemaking, he was treated reasonably well by his Moorish captors, who were under the impression, given his noble bearing and his courageous spirit, that he was a man of distinction and perhaps worth a considerable ransom. And one can guess that Miguel, creative as he was, did very little to dispel this misconception. The charade, no doubt, kept him alive, but also kept him prisoner for 5 years, because it took his poor family that long to raise the ransom for a nobleman. Finally, being released, he returned to Spain, but it was all over. Though King Philip had given him a citation for his bravery, he gave him nothing else. For several years, Cervantes endured a miserable and menial existence as a tax collector. And then in 1602, he began with his good hand to write Don Quixote, the novel which made him immortal, which became a masterpiece model of literature, and which allowed him to live out his memories and his fantasies of heroism. The novel picks up Quixote where Cervantes' life seems to be ending, old, tattered, bedeviled, but unbloodied and unbowed, full of energy still, and most importantly, filled with ideals and with hope. Cervantes becomes his creation, becomes Quixote, and begins his new life with these words. When the preparations had been completed, the old gentleman could hardly wait to put his plan into action. He was grieved by each moment of delay, for the world was weary of wrongs which only he could make right, of evils which he must purge from the face of the earth, and of unreasonable things and abuses which he was called upon to correct. And so he dressed up in his armor, buckled up his patched-up helmet, mounted his horse Rocinante, and setting his lance and grasping his shield, he sailed forth through the back gates of his corral out into the open field. So begins the adventures of a self-appointed knight. And what adventures they were. The joust at the windmill giants, the burning but chaste love for Lady Dulcinea, the setting free of questionable maidens, battle with a black knight, and with lions, accompanied by the ever faithful, though oft reluctant, Sancho Panza. Living in a Spain which, like an aging, disillusioned warrior, had lost its pride and its zeal, Cervantes, through Quixote, seeks to restore the compelling power of the ideal, the power of dreaming the impossible dream. Quixote will set out to save a world in which evil is rewarded and virtue hardly at all. The sagging society, the reluctant spirit astride a mule, spouting dull maxims, proverbs, and rules to live by, is personified in his companion, Sancho Panza. For every wild adventure the Don proposes, Sancho has his never-absent proverb, his cautioning restraint of reality. Those are not giants, those are merely windmills. Those are not armies preparing to clash. They are merely sheep in a dusty field. But the dawn prevails. The battle is joined against impossible odds. And Sancho picks up the pieces, patches up his windmill-battered master, utters more conventional wisdom about how things are as they are, and on they go to the next adventure. And finally, at the end, Don Quixote dies. The dialogue between real and ideal is over, and Sancho retires to a life of maxim and proverb. It's sometimes said that Sancho tagged along because he too had a dream of glory, though perhaps not as idealistic as Quixote's. After all, the Don had promised to make him an emperor, or at least the king of an army. Well, maybe an ambassador. But there was more to Sancho than that. One does not risk getting one's head busted by a black knight with no sense of humor just for an unlikely to come fruition promise. Sancho Panza in this story is here because he can't get out of it. Quixote was Cervantes, and Sancho was Cervantes. Sancho and Don were each aspects of a dual, conflicting nature we all possess. Quixote is that part of us which dreams, hopes, has visions, strains the ties that bind us in our place, fixes us to the merely possible, the barely endurable. And Sancho would save us from ourselves, let other, stronger, richer, younger adventurers fight for the right, be all that they can be. Sancho would keep us safe at home. Though it must be said, if we persist in dreaming, he will come along, knowing in his homey wisdom how the world can shatter the armor and beat down the waning defenses, and how fortunate we are if we have someone to carry us home. When we laugh at the Don and at his loyal follower, we laugh at ourselves and recognize within ourselves a dialogue between our own crusading and cautious spirits. Who among us has not dreamed an impossible dream? We dream things to be real that are not real at all. We experiment with a life that is given, that is what it is, if only in moments of fantasy. In private moments, we live as if the ideal were real. And like Sancho, we too are armed with maxims and proverbs, with traditions and habits which keep us rooted where we are, settled in traditional wisdom about the nature of things, sensibly calling windmills just windmills, standing aside while others do battle with the giants. It has been said that Don Quixote is the funny story of a madman, blithely setting aside the obvious problems of attempting to analyze a figure of fiction. Psychiatrists from time to time have, in all seriousness, attempted to offer up analysis and diagnosis of Don Quixote, offering differingly, heatedly with each other, as psychiatrists tend to do, about which psychoses would apply to Don Quixote. But Quixote was not mad. He was a man possessed by ideals, and there's a world of difference. He knows, for example, that the enchanters do not really change shape. They merely appear to do so. Quixote knows that evil is not so foolish as to appear before us as evil. It is not madness, but imagination that rules Quixote. He is the poet philosopher, the poet in action, defending the rights of the imagination, insisting crash after crash and beating after beating that what human minds can dream, human beings can do. Like all knights, good and true, Quixote has a lady fair, Quixote and Dulcinea, a maiden pure and virtuous, in whose name he fights for the good. Her name is Dulcinea. She is the personification of the ideal. But is she real? Is the ideal real? Again, Quixote does not suffer from delusions. He says of the lady Dulcinea, God knows whether there is a Dulcinea in this world. I contemplate her as she needs must be. In this, Cervantes has a remarkable intuition, an intuition shared by the existentialists such as Kierkegaard and Jean-Paul Sartre, those who have maintained that we cannot have knowledge of anything ideal or absolute. And so if we choose to live at all, we must live as if. God knows whether or not there is a God. Kierkegaard spoke of the leap of faith. We go as far as reason will take us, to the edge where knowledge and certainty end, and from there we fall into despair that there is nothing. Or we leap into the faith, imagining the ideals which make life worthwhile and living by them as if they were real. Quixote's Dulcinea is the symbol of the ideal. God knows whether or not there is a Dulcinea in this world. Quixote says, I contemplate her as she must be. It does not matter, you see, whether Dulcinea is real or not. Quixote lives as if she is. And you and I must make beauty, truth, and justice, do the good, and live as if those are real, in spite of all the beatings and the ugly windmills and the black knights. In Quixote and Sancho Panza, we recognize ourselves as ordinary folk who dream impossible dreams. If, like Don Quixote, we have the courage of the philosopher-poet to defend the reality of the imagination, to not only dream the dreams but follow them, then we must suffer the realities that would turn our dreams to dust. We dream in our Disney Christian culture, of an impossible dream world of happy endings to our boundless hopes. And Sancho Panza ever with us keeps saying it isn't so. But we must choose to live as if it is so. Otherwise, how could we live? How could we live if we could not believe that our hopes will be fulfilled? For the end of hope is despair, and despair is hell, or at least the purgatory of a meaningless existence. So in spite of Sancho's warnings, we charge ahead with our hopes, and when our hopes and we come crashing down, and the ground is hard, and the lance is broken by the real, hard, unyielding windmills, Sancho is there still, collecting what is left of us, scurrying about, muttering, "I told you so, I told you so," picking us up and setting us back astride the world to have another go at it. There's another dream, the dream that life is essentially just, that all things make sense together, and that all things work ultimately for the good. How boundless and persistent is that dream? Goodness is its own reward. The meek shall inherit the earth. The arc of the universe bends toward justice. Martin Luther King notwithstanding, there is no arc in the universe. There is just the universe. How marvelous and how necessary it is, and how crushing is the reality again and again. That justice is not necessarily in the nature of things, that life is often capricious, unreasonable, and unfair, beaten down again by the weight of the superior force of reality, our Sancho lifts us to our feet, dusts us off, rearranges the slight armor that barely protects us, and sets us off to dream again of a harmonious world. Join another march, write another letter, join another committee, go to another meeting. Another dream, another dream. Like the one that life is fair, the dream that lives can be planned. We prepare ourselves for a glorious future. We guide our children in our footsteps. We save our money. We make promises to ourselves and think to have bound the future to our plans. What a surprise. What shock. To sit dazed beneath the tree, watching the wind and fire and rain take it all away with willful children who have ideas of their own. Warriors, politicians, economists, or that monster, mindless public stupidity, bringing our plans to nothing. And when the plans, the contrivances lie in smoldering ashes, our Sancho kicks about in the embers looking for remains, for scorched but usable bits from which to make another dream. For in spite of all the warnings, in spite of all the maxims about living for the day, we are creatures who, if we are to live at all, must live in the past as we remember it, in the present as it is, and in the future as who knows. Another dream, that we will live forever. We dream of life everlasting, fascinated with modern potions and elixirs. We diet, we dance away from dying, we run away from death dressed in funny costumes. The heart pounding to visions of immortality as the hand of heaven nips at our nails. The knights and the noble gents and ladies who lie marble encased in ancient churches have their carved likenesses lying on their tombs, likenesses of themselves in the bloom of youth and warriorhood, never old, never dead, merely sleeping. But death comes, mindless, heedless, like a cosmic hand flicking away a speck of dust. Death means nothing to death itself. In spite of it, in spite of the terror of it, in spite of the loss of those we love, in spite of the dying of those like us whom we had thought immortal, we persist in the immortal dream, the impossible dream of life everlasting. The cleverest live as if they will live forever and as if they will die tomorrow. Another dream and another, this dream and that. It is a long book that Cervantes wrote, for there were many adventures in the life of Don Quixote. Many giants to be faced down, many innocents to save, prisoners and slaves to be set free. Back and forth between impossible dream and necessary reality. The Quixote part of self and the Sancho, the ideal questing that keeps life vital, and the common sense that makes life just ordered enough most of the time to be endurable and possible. Without Sancho, Quixote would never have survived a day's adventure. Without the Don, Sancho would never have survived a day's adventure. Without the potential glory of life as adventure, we need them both in the days of our lives. 4 days before his death, Michael Miguel Cervantes wrote to the Count of Limas, now a friend and finally a patron. He wrote with 1 foot in the stirrup, and with the agony of death upon me, I write to you. Yesterday they gave me extreme unction. The time is short, my pains are increasing, my hopes are diminishing, and yet with it all, the desire I have to live keeps me alive. Cervantes' Quixote knew poverty, scorn, imprisonment, but through it all and in all, the desire to live, and not merely to live, but to live the impossible dream that the ideal is real. It is the only way to live and to be truly alive, tilting at windmills.